From the Voice of America in Washington, this is VOA Asia Weekend. I'm Jim Stevenson with a wrap-up of the stories that were featured in our VOA Asia programs through the week. This program is available on VOA Asia's Facebook page and on our website, voanews.com. Ahead on today's program,
we have been provoked. The world has been provoked. We don't want that. We want stability, not chaos. And we want peace, not war.
On his first presidential trip to Asia, Donald Trump emphasizes trade and unity against North Korean missile threats. We'll hear more about his stops this week in Vietnam and the Philippines, plus much more on VOA Asia Weekend. President Trump arrived in Manila for summits with eager but suspicious Southeast Asian leaders. Trump's early morning landing on Air Force One came just after about 3,500 Filipino protesters tried to march on the U.S. embassy. The protesters shouted for Trump to leave and accused the U.S. government, a former Philippine colonizer of about 50 years, of looking for overseas wars. Thousands of riot police blocked protesters who were organized in part by a minor left-leaning political party from reaching the embassy or any venues where Trump was scheduled to attend summits organized by the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. Before arriving in Manila, Trump met in Hanoi with Vietnamese President Tran Đại Quang, and afterwards Trump praised Vietnam for recently becoming the fastest-growing export market to the United States.
We've come a long way, the United States and Vietnam. We've seen it from both sides of the picture. And this is the pleasant side. You are doing a spectacular job. Your people are doing a spectacular job. And in the United States, likewise.
He added he is confident that American energy, agriculture, financial services, aviation, digital commerce, and defense products are able to meet all of Vietnam's many commercial needs and meet those needs better than anybody else. Trump and Quang also discussed North Korea and the South China Sea. Trump repeated his warning that North Korea represents a major threat to peace and stability in the region.
Safety and security are goals that should unite all civilized nations. We want progress, not provocation. I mean, we have been provoked. The world has been provoked. We don't want that. We want stability, not chaos. And we want peace, not war.
During his bilateral meeting with Quang, Trump also offered his services as a mediator for the South China Sea dispute. When asked about the offer at a press conference, Quang would only say Vietnam seeks a peaceful resolution to the issue through negotiations and in line with international law. Prior to his arrival in Hanoi, Trump was in the central Vietnamese city of Da Nang, where he attended the annual Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit. Trump joined 17 other heads of state in Manila for discussions touching on North Korea, the South China Sea, and terrorism from a Southeast Asian angle. Although trade was high on Mr. Trump's agenda, it did not include the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which the president quickly pulled out of when he took office, claiming it hurt American jobs. Still, 11 countries in the TPP are moving ahead without the United States. The agreement forward is a boost for the principle of multilateral trade pacts. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke with Dr. William Hawk, associate professor at the Darla Moore School of Business at the University of South Carolina, about who stands where on the issue.
Well, right now it's pretty much all of the other original TPP countries against the United States. This is something they had worked on for a very long time, I mean, dating back to 6-7 years worth of negotiations. And really when President Trump pulled us out of the TPP arrangement really on his first full day in office. That really left a lot of these countries who had been negotiating for a long time hanging.
So where does this stand? In a speech in Da Nang, President Trump, as I'm sure you heard, sent out a very strong message that he was only interested in bilateral deals in Asia and that would not disadvantage the United States. And at the same time, or just a while later, the Chinese President Xi Jinping told the same forum to stress multilateralism, and he said globalization was an irreversible trend. Is that basically the crux of the argument here?
I think that really is a big part of it, is really I think what the Trump administration would like to do is negotiate with countries one-on-one as much as possible. However, this would go against the multilateral framework that that the TPP was trying to set up in the Pacific Rim. Now, with the United States withdrawing, the remaining countries are trying to make a go of it on their own. But sitting on the sidelines is China, who would really like to have a multilateral framework that they're at the center at. And I think, you know, that's really the big geopolitical issue going forward, is can China step into this vacuum created by the U.S. withdrawal from the TPP?
Is that a danger as far as you're concerned, as far as the United States is concerned?
Well, it's a problem both on an economic and a political front. I think one of the biggest political issues in Asia going forward is how do we manage the rise of China, which is now becoming a major player on the world stage and would like to be the predominant power in Asia. The question is then, can the United States set up a multilateral framework to have a system of alliances and trading partnerships and so forth that would make sure that the U.S. is still a major player in Asia? And that's really a big part of what the TPP was designed to do. The Trump administration may have some luck negotiating bilateral trade deals, but I think there's going to be sort of a bad taste in their mouth amongst a lot of potential partners in that as a result of the U.S. withdrawal from TPP.
President Trump's campaign pledge was that this was costing jobs and pulling out would mean more jobs for Americans. Does that translate as far as economics are concerned?
That's really a difficult thing to say. Certainly, we see that U.S. manufacturing sector, especially the more labor-intensive parts of U.S. manufacturing, have been squeezed in the last few decades. But that has as much to do with changing technology as much as with trade. And even on the trade front, I don't think it's been trade agreements so much that have undermined American businesses as the fact that the U.S. is really, I think the U.S. dollar is very, very strong relative to a lot of Asian currencies. And I think the currency issue is really the bigger one, which is usually outside the scope of trade agreements.
As you followed this story, Japan has been lobbying hard for the TPP. The TPP aims to eliminate tariffs on industrial and farm products across the bloc. What does the U.S. absence from the TPP mean on an overall scale for both the United States and Asian countries, including China?
Well, I think without the U.S. being a part of the TPP, part of what a lot of countries were hoping to get out of it, better access to the U.S. market, is off the table to a certain extent. Now, the flip side of that is that if the remaining members of the TPP bloc form a trade agreement amongst themselves that lower trade barriers and make it easier for goods and investment to flow across their borders, that'll also keep U.S. firms out of what would still be a pretty large trading bloc, even without the United States in it. And then, of course, you know, the issue is, can China, by virtue of being the next largest market out there, can they end up negotiating with the remaining TPP members to get an advantage in those markets? I think that's really what could potentially be harmful to the United States down the road.
Dr. William Hawk is associate professor at the Darla Moore School of Business at the University of South Carolina. Dr. Hawk, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Stay with VOA Asia Weekend for more on Mr. Trump's Asia trip. Right now on VOA Asia Weekend, the United Nations says more than 611,000 Rohingya refugees have arrived in Bangladesh from Myanmar since August 25th. A survey conducted by the UN Refugee Agency of more than 500,000 Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh finds one-third are vulnerable and in need of special assistance. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The undertaking took place in the Kutupalong camp, in numerous makeshift settlements and extension areas in Cox's Bazar. It was conducted jointly by the UN Refugee Agency and Bangladesh's Relief and Repatriation Commission. The UNHCR reports more than 100 people were hired to go shelter to shelter to gather data on more than 120,000 families comprising nearly 518,000 refugees. The agency's spokeswoman, Dunia Aslam Khan, says most of the earliest new arrivals in Bangladesh were women and children. She tells VOA it was decided to conduct this survey to assess their vulnerability and see what help was most needed.
And according to the data so far collected, we have a number of households headed by single mothers without any male support. We have younger children who are now taking care of their sibling. We have elderly grandparents who have no support from younger family members because they are either killed or separated.
Khan says many people suffer from various disabilities and many children are separated from their families. She says all these people will require special life-saving support. She says the findings will be shared with government authorities and all humanitarian agencies. She says an analysis of the data will permit aid agencies to target their assistance where it will do the most good. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to VOA Asia Weekend. As President Trump works to boost U.S. exports to Asia, ranchers in the Midwestern U.S. state of Nebraska are now raising beef for tables in China. Their trade to the world's second-largest economy had been suspended more than a decade ago during concerns over mad cow disease. From Nebraska, VOA reporter Abby Sun tells us how U.S. beef producers are changing to meet Chinese food safety requirements.
Rancher Terry Beller has 5,000 head of cattle on his family feedlot outside Lindsay, Nebraska, and he is looking for more. But not just any animal will make the cut here, where cattle gain weight before the slaughterhouse.
How are you guys?
Good.
Travel long?
Meeting in town with friends selling cattle from Idaho, Beller is looking only for livestock that meets strict standards required for beef sales to China. President Xi Jinping and Donald Trump reopened that market during their first official meeting, opening a big new market for Nebraska, where international beef exports already top $1 billion a year.
China is a huge marketplace with a rising middle class that is looking for quality products like U.S. beef.
Nebraska Governor Pete Ricketts says Chinese markets could be worth $200 million a year.
That's a potentially close to a 20% increase. So the work that President Trump did to work with President Xi to get that marketplace opened up has potentially a tremendous impact for our producers here in our state.
F27890, which matches up with 56731.
But that opportunity comes with higher costs. Certifying age, origin, and non-hormone status with digital tracking from birth to packaging means an extra $150 a head. So Beller needs a higher price for Chinese beef.
I think once they get a taste of our high-quality beef that it will sell good, and we're hoping, you know, to get back to that $225 to $250 a head.
Now we're here at the Greater Omaha in Nebraska, where the live animal turned into carcass, being cut into different parts and packed right in front of us, ready to ship all over the world.
Even Nebraska meat packers must track the beef meant for China.
Where we're at now is the carcass cooler. Where we've not been is the harvest floor, and they'll go into the fabrication room where they make different cuts, meaning some of these cattle might be for Europe, some may be for China, some may be for Saudi Arabia.
Once certified under China's beef export verification program, Terry Beller is betting that those higher standards will help Nebraska beef beat out global competition. Abby Sun for VOA News, Lindsay, Nebraska.
Autistic children often face social difficulties no matter where they live. They tend to linger on the edges of social groups at school and have fewer friendships than those without the condition. but that can change if their classmates understand them and give them a chance. As VOA's Faiza El-Masri tells us in this report narrated by Faith Lapidus, an Australian mother wrote and illustrated a children's book to help kids do that.
The family dog is Hugo Alexander's best friend. The 6-year-old has moderate functioning autism and an intellectual disability. His mother, Misha Alexander, says getting Hugo out the door is a struggle almost every morning.
My day-to-day life with Hugo is incredibly taxing. Takes a lot of energy just to get him ready for school.
As the mother of an autistic child, she's always felt she needed to make other children and teachers aware of his condition.
When Hugo was in preschool, I made flyers that I put into all the pigeonholes for all of his peers and their families to understand what was up with Hugo.
When Hugo started elementary school, she felt she had to educate even more people about the condition so they could better understand autism.
And I thought, that's when I'm going to write a book, and I'm going to help bridge that gap so that there's more transparency between disabilities and typical children.
His name is Fergus.
Alexander wrote Fergus and Delilah, a children's book about a child who's a little different and trying to make friends. The book is designed to be used at schools and at home.
The message I hope to spread is that we all need to be inclusive, make different the norm.
The book has received positive feedback.
I haven't actually seen any in my 10 years in the industry. I haven't seen any sort of really good comprehensive resources that are available to children, young children in particular.
Raising awareness about autism by telling an interesting, colorful story might be the first step toward breaking down barriers and making life easier for Hugo and kids like him. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
This is VOA Asia Weekend. A recent report by the World Health Organization and the World Bank say climate change and pollution are damaging the health of millions every year. VOA's Kevin Enix tells us the increasing impact of water scarcity adds to the problem, and places like Jordan could foretell a troubling future in many parts of the world.
To many Jordanian farmers, the nation's water crisis is already here.
I have 28 hectares. I used to plant 16 hectares with citrus fruits and 12 hectares with bananas. Now I plant 6 hectares with bananas because of the water shortage. Before, we used to have enough water. But now we don't have enough water to grow bananas because of lack of rainfall and of water shortage.
This is the Yarmouk River. Once an important water source for the Middle Eastern Kingdom, these days it is a trickle of water.
Believe me, the decision makers, on top of them, the Minister of Water and Irrigation, I don't believe that they sleep well every day because of the scarcity of water and thinking about water supply for all the sectors.
And a new report suggests it's going to get worse.
The climate change shown that we are in trouble in the future, where all the resources will be less, around 30%. And without climate change, we are in trouble. On top of this crisis will be the climate change in addition to the refugees, the fluxes, which may make the life very difficult for Jordan to manage the water sector.
Government officials say the only real solution to their water troubles is desalination technology. But Jordan is almost completely landlocked.
And desalination, as you know, it's far away from the central part of Jordan, around 350 kilometers, which needs a huge amount or investment to transfer, to desalinate the water and to transfer the water to the governorate needed this type of water.
In addition to getting more water, taking better care of the water they have is a necessity. The government estimates as much as half of Jordan's water supply is wasted.
There is a room to use water better. We need to support the government in its effort to improve the irrigation network, improve the household utilization of water, improve the use of water in agriculture. In terms, we need to produce more from the drops of water in agriculture.
For now, the government says it is cracking down on illegal water use increasing water prices, and will start diverting more wastewater for agriculture. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
You're listening to VOA Asia Weekend. Members of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations reportedly will start negotiations with China on a code of conduct to ease maritime tensions in the South China Sea. A draft statement at the 10-nation ASEAN summit in Manila said it is important to cooperate to, quote, maintain peace, stability, freedom of navigation in and over flights above the vital waterway to avoid miscalculations that could lead to escalation of tensions. Host Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte earlier suggested that despite differences, there should be no effort to confront China on the matter.
Today, China is the number one economic power, and we have to be friends. The other hotheads would like us to confront China and the rest of the world for so many issues. The South China Sea is better left untouched. Nobody can afford to go to war. Either the big powers, Russia, China, Britain, or the United States, it can ill afford a violent confrontation.
Mr. Duterte met with President Donald Trump on the sidelines of the summit, and the matter of the controversial anti-drug crackdown underway in the Philippines did not come up. Rights groups have condemned the crackdown, which has officially left nearly 4,000 dead since last year, for allegedly employing extrajudicial killings. Asia Foundation analyst Stephen Rood, a visiting fellow at the Australian National University, tells VOA's Victor Beatty there remains general support for the crackdown among the Philippines populace.
It is indeed, particularly in the cities, quite a vicious problem. So when asked if they approve of the president's war on drugs, they tend to say that they do indeed support it. However, there is growing concern about the fact that so many people are killed in the course of that war, and that concern has been growing. So in the end, if that's the only way that the drug war is being fought, it could undercut support for it.
Nearly 4,000, according to these media reports, have died since this drug crackdown began when Mr. Duterte took office a little more than a year ago.
4,000 is the number that the police count as having been killed in their operations, and there's an approximately equivalent number who've been killed in considerably more murky circumstances. So we are talking about thousands of people who have been killed, and the average Filipino would like to see anybody charged with such a crime face trial rather than being summarily slain.
Describe to me the importance of this ASEAN meeting in Manila for Mr. Duterte.
This is really the chance for President Duterte to come out in the international scene. I mean, he's been president for more than a year, but his performance at previous international meetings has been somewhat sporadic, missing dinners and skipping meetings and the like, whereas here he is the host for all the world's leaders and has a chance to demonstrate his more congenial side.
He's indicated that the South China Sea issue probably will not be discussed, better left untouched, in his words, even though President Donald Trump has indicated he's prepared to mediate the situation.
In fact, there's a couple of different perspectives on this. The United States' clear objective is to ensure freedom of navigation and not to take any particular position on who owns those areas. Whereas what President Duterte is saying is he's not going to insist on answering the question of who owns the different islands and shoals and the like, as long as he is able to get both Philippine fishermen access to those waters and Chinese investment in the Philippines.
Earlier in Vietnam, Mr. Trump offered to mediate tensions in the South China Sea. After meeting with Mr. Duterte on Monday, the president praised ASEAN's 50-year dedication to building consensus on critical issues facing the Indo-Pacific region. The United States has long been the destination for students around the world, especially from Asia. For a second consecutive year, over a million international students have come to U.S. schools, according to a new report. The 2017 Open Doors Report on International Education Exchange notes that in the 2016-2017 school year, the United States played host to a record 1.08 million international students. That marks an increase of 3% from last year, but the report noted that while the total number of international students in the United States increased, the number of new students did not. VOA Asia's Ira Melman contacted Scott Stevens. He's the director of the English Language Institute at the University of Delaware. Ira asked Stevens why this is happening.
One of the important factors is the strength of the U.S. dollar. This has really hit hard for students coming from South America, Africa, Europe, and different parts of Southeast Asia, not necessarily China. And then you add to that some of the political unrest that there's been in Brazil, which impeached its president, and South Korea, which impeached its president, and Venezuela, which has sunk into some level of chaos, and that's impacted enrollments as well. And then also the Saudi Arabia had taken a pause, primarily, I think, initially with the decrease cost of the barrel of crude oil, which depressed markets throughout the Middle East. They'd taken a pause on their scholarship program and restructured it, and those students are starting to come back, but in slower numbers. And then I suppose one could add the Trump effect to it and the travel ban, which is maybe given some students a sense that they're less welcome here. I don't think that's true, but that might be some of the perception.
When it comes to the University of Delaware, I know that you have probably been speaking with students. Have they expressed to you any reluctance about the choice that they have made?
No, we were fortunate in that our particular intensive English program actually saw a 6% increase in enrollment, and our undergraduate enrollments increased as well by about 10%. And our students seem very happy here. I think a lot of what's going on is it may be that the numbers have started to level off, but I think students and their parents are beginning to shop quality, and I think they're looking for programs that universities that really support them, that make them feel a part of the campus, that promote their engagement with domestic students and other international students. And I think all those things have a factor. And if students feel they're getting real value for their tremendous investment in a U.S. higher education.
The proceeding has been an unpaid commercial announcement from the University of Delaware. But nevertheless, I mean, the number of foreign students, especially from China and other Asian nations and India, have proven a needed financial boom for a lot of universities. Is that correct?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think with particularly state support diminishing for so many U.S. universities, they're turning to where to make up those dollars. And part of the movement has been in the so-called public Ivies, where state universities are competing with other state universities to draw their students out of state so they can pay out-of-state tuition rate. And the other factor has been a real focus on international student recruitment, and international students tend to come over without scholarships, tend to pay full sticker price, and a lot of university presidents count on that to hold up their budgets.
Have you in any way changed your recruitment process in the wake of this?
We have redoubled our recruitment efforts, and we're trying to reach other countries because it's important for us to have diverse enrollment. And we're looking at things like opening up University of Delaware offices in China and in Korea. And I think it's really important for universities to have sort of an on-the-ground presence rather than come in, do an educational fair, and then leave. One of the difficult things is the opportunities like a domestic student has to come and see your campus and explore and to meet faculty. And international students have to sort of do this with much less information and much less firsthand experience. So having a continuous presence and more information and visiting faculty on a regular basis, I think, can help them and their parents make informed decisions.
What would you say to a prospective student and his or her parents about thoughts that might be deterring them from coming to study in the United States?
I would say to basically do your homework. Look at areas of the country that are, for example, safe. Look at the reputation of the universities, not just overall reputation, but with the particular major that the son or daughter is choosing to study, because a school may have an overall good reputation but not be as strong in a particular field. And then look at the level of support. Do you get to live on campus with other international students? Is there robust cultural programming to have international students meet American students? Is there a thorough orientation? Is there a pre-departure orientation in your country? Does that university take the time to reach out to you and involve the parents and communicate with the parents? You know, most students are very relational, and so trust your friends that have been to other schools and talk to them about their experience and whether or not they feel welcome and have a true sense of identity, and not just follow the headlines. You know, America is a big country, and there's a lot of places where students can go and thrive.
VOA Asia's Ira Melman speaking with Scott Stevens, director of the English Language Institute at the University of Delaware, a university that hosts over 3,100 students from outside of the United States. A recent survey assessing how well women are protected from sexual violence in the world's megacities found that London, Tokyo, and Paris are the best places for women, while Cairo, Karachi, Kinshasa, New Delhi, and Sao Paulo are the worst. The Thomson Reuters Foundation study, published in October, was based on surveys with 380 experts on women's issues in 19 of the world's biggest megacities. In the case of New Delhi, a metropolis of 26 million people, a number of factors make it unsafe for women, as Rital Jossi reports.
The Indian capital of Delhi has long been labeled a dangerous city, especially for women.
Delhi is particularly unsafe. I really wouldn't say that. But I think it is the fact that there is so much of reporting in Delhi, and also that there is so much of conversation around sexual harassment and sexual violence, different kinds of violence against women in Delhi.
These voices became especially loud following the brutal gang rape of a young woman inside a bus in December 2012. The rape of the young woman, who later died, shook the Indian capital and led to tougher laws. But Indian women say things have not changed that much.
If you're walking, you are like kind of a showpiece for everybody, because all the people around you will stare at you no matter what.
Stepping out in the night, one has to think twice. If you're on your own,
nobody has any fear in Delhi. People think that whatever they do with women, this system will not be able to do anything. Delhi police themselves have asked for an 80,000 increase in their force for the past 10 years. It hasn't increased to this day.
According to India's National Crime Records Bureau, New Delhi saw a whopping 184% increase in cases of crime against women in 2016. This figure was the highest for any Indian city. Professional women like Drishti Day say they are on guard each time they leave the house.
Living in Delhi, girls are taught at a very young age that we must be home before 7. Or if we have to go to a party with friends, our brother can go, but we cannot. And if a girl does take that risk, and if something happens, then it is that girl's wrongdoing because she went alone.
While Delhi has a long way to go before it can be considered a safe city for women, experts say as more women enter the workforce, they will become a more visible and vocal part of the capital's life. And this will help change society's patriarchal mindset. Ritul Joshi for VOA News, New Delhi.
You're listening to VOA Asia Weekend. President Donald Trump has declared his 12-day five-nation Asia trip a success. On his way back to Washington, Mr. Trump said he made a lot of great friends and suggested the United States will no longer be taken advantage of on trade. He predicted that relationship will be fair and reciprocal. The president, without elaborating, said the United States sold $300 billion in equipment and other things and expected that number to be quadrupled quickly. The Washington Post said Mr. Trump's trip was designed to offer a vision for U.S. foreign policy and reassure allies at a time of tension involving North Korea and the South China Sea. The paper's analysis said Mr. Trump offered conflicting versions of its Asia policy. Associate editor Ankit Panda, the Asia-Pacific publication The Diplomat, tells VOA's Victor Beatty he views the trip as having mixed results.
We saw the president deliver an address in Vietnam, for example, around a theme of a free and open Asia Pacific, which is what the administration is effectively calling its broader strategic outlook towards the Asia Pacific. Additionally, we saw the first ever meeting at a fairly low level, at the working group level of the Quadrilateral Initiative after 10 years. This was a meeting of diplomats from Japan, the United States, India, and Australia, forming a sort of concert of democracies of like-minded states that value the same things in the Asia Pacific. That said, I think there is also something to be said for the broader undiplomatic insults that we saw levied against Kim Jong-un, and also, you know, just a broader absence of normative issues, including human rights and values, which didn't feature too prominently, even in Japan and South Korea, where I would say President Trump was moderately successful in reassuring these allies. We saw very little sense of a democratic solidarity or solidarity with these allies in the context of the alliance. A lot of President Trump's behavior did come off as transactional. So I think the assessment is mixed at the end of the day.
Does that give China an opportunity? One analyst said Trump is a godsend for China's rise.
There has been a lot of analysis that I think has treated this as a gift for China, the fact that the United States appears to be a little bit adrift. I wouldn't go that far. I think the Chinese did succeed in flattering President Trump in a way that resulted in a fairly smooth visit for him in Beijing, where uncomfortable issues ranging from the South China Sea to North Korea to the trade imbalance didn't get the kind of attention that many observers had hoped for. That said, I think China remains unable to fully capitalize so far on what appears to be United States adrift. Beijing's rhetoric and Beijing's actions continue to demonstrate a degree of divergence. We see some reports treating President Xi Jinping's statements on free and open trade, which China claims to support. Effectively, we see those words being taken for granted without a broader scrutiny of Chinese trade and investment practices. So it's far from clear that the Chinese will be able to benefit from this trip in the way that some observers have suggested. But certainly, as far as the comparative differences go between the U.S. and China, I think China will have something to gain here.
Ankit Panda said Mr. Trump's message to leaders of the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation meeting in Vietnam represented a clear divergence from previous U.S. administrations, that the U.S. is now prepared to go on its own way on trade by cutting bilateral deals. APEC, he said, is designed to pursue liberalized multilateral trade and represents a bit of a retrenchment. He described the trip as, overall, a success, simply because it didn't fail. He said the president showed great stamina and did succeed in reassuring Japan and South Korea regarding the North Korean threat. During his first presidential trip to Asia, Donald Trump developed a sudden affinity for the phrase Indo-Pacific, not Asia or Asia-Pacific, as had been the term used by many referring to the area. Does Indo-Pacific give some insight into how the U.S. views the region? To get an answer to that question, VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke with Murray Hebert, a senior associate of the Southeast Asia program at the Washington-based Center for Strategic and International Studies. He asked Hebert what this change means.
Well, we're all trying busily to understand it. Obviously, one thing it means is that it is, you know, we've often, traditionally, we've talked about the Asia-Pacific. By doing the Indo-Pacific, it's a clear reference to the fact that U.S. wants to connect the Pacific and Indian Ocean so that India and South Asia are included in the broad sweep of Asia. So it was also initially unfurled, I guess, at a speech that Secretary Tillerson gave just before Trump's visit. Tillerson was off to India, and when he started to use this term, and really made it very clear that it was going to be an effort to draw India more into the Asia deliberations. That some of it seemed like he highly lauded India, criticized China a lot, which made it suggested that that might be an effort for the U.S. to work with India and probably some other countries like Japan and Australia to provide a check or a hedge against China.
What does the inclusion or what does the addition of India mean to the whole geopolitical structure of this all?
Well, obviously, India is a very big country. like China, you know, well over a billion people. But India has been relatively underrepresented in the rest of Asia. It is not, for example, a member of the APEC, the Asia-Pacific Economic Community, which Mr. Trump just attended in Vietnam. India has been a much smaller economic partner, smaller trading partner. And I think so this is an attempt to draw India more into the growth and dynamism of the rest of Asia. The Japanese, Australians, Indians, and Americans met at a senior official level to start figuring out how they could cooperate more. They call them the Quad for short, how they could cooperate to have greater influence in the region. But again, that was also relatively undefined.
What does this mean for China as far as what we understand so far of this concept?
President Trump didn't allude too much to China, but Secretary Tillerson did and talked about how democratic countries live by the rule of law. He criticized China for, you know, not respecting intellectual property rights, for stealing technology, for forcing technology transfers, some of those concerns, as well as alluded to China's more assertive behavior in the South China Sea, and talked. Secretary Tillerson used the words predatory when referring to some of China's policies, which attracted a lot of attention. So. I think we're going to, you know, again, this is another aspect that we were going to have to sort of watch as it evolves over the next few months.
What's been China's reaction so far?
They have not said a lot, but some of the reaction has been that we don't see this as aimed at us. So they don't see it as targeted at them. So I think you would expect China probably to downplay it, at least initially, until they see how the free and open Indo-Pacific is implemented.
Why would President Trump continue to use the phrase if no one seems to know what it means yet?
Well, I guess they're looking for like a bumper sticker kind of a slogan that you can use to describe the policy. You remember President Obama used the words initially pivot to Asia and then the rebalance to Asia. Obviously, President Trump wants to change those policies and certainly have changed the name. I think it's I alluded to those other policies of President Obama because it took a while for them to put meat on the bones so that people could figure out what the content was. So I think this is going to be very much a work in progress as they try to spell out in greater detail what it means.
Murray Hebert is a senior associate of the Southeast Asia program at the Washington Bay Center for Strategic and International Studies. Murray, thanks so much for trying to explain this.
Thanks. You're welcome.
Listening to VOA Asia Weekend. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, on a visit to Myanmar, expressed concern over credible reports of widespread atrocities committed by security forces and vigilantes in Rakhine State, but said broad-based economic sanctions against the country would not be advisable. After announcing that the United States will provide an additional $47 million in aid to Rohingya refugees, bringing the total this year to $87 million, Tillerson said, "We want to see Myanmar succeed."
The crisis in Rakhine State is one of the greatest challenges Myanmar has faced since the elected government came into office last year. We're deeply concerned by credible reports of widespread atrocities committed by Myanmar's security forces and by vigilantes who were unrestrained by the security forces during the recent violence in Rakhine State. We're also distressed by the fact that hundreds of thousands of men, women and children have been forced to flee.
We hear more now on the story from VOA State Department correspondent Cindy Sain, who tells VOA Asia's Ira Melman who the Secretary of State met.
The Secretary met with Myanmar's army chief, and he also met with a state counselor and former opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi. And afterwards, Tillerson had a joint press conference with Aung San Suu Kyi. And he did say that he did not think that broad-based sanctions against the entire country would be helpful at this time, but that the U.S. would consider some individual sanctions against people found responsible for the violence. And he said that he is very concerned about the suffering of the Rohingya people.
What did he say about the phrase being used that's open to question, that being that this whole situation is a case of textbook ethnic cleansing?
Well, he said that basically we're not there yet, that that needs to be studied and considered if that is the case. But he said that the United States does call for an end to the violence and also announced that the U.S. is giving an additional $47 million in humanitarian aid to try and help the refugees. And he also said something that was interesting. He called for the Myanmar government to allow refugees to return, to create safe conditions for their return, including, he said, a pathway to citizenship, which has been a very sore subject because Myanmar has never considered the Rohingya citizens of the country.
Aung San Suu Kyi, the at least civilian leader of Myanmar, has been heavily criticized for her silence or avoidance of controversial issues when speaking about this. What did she have to say?
Well, she was asked about that very point, Ira, and she said that she has not been silent, but that she has been careful about what she said. She said we mustn't forget that there are many different communities in the Rakhine and that they're to live together in peace. We can't set them against each other. She said she's making very careful statements, and she doesn't want to drive people farther apart.
Did she give any kind of indication of how she feels about the criticism coming her way and to her country?
Well, she did say that, you know, she rejected the criticism and said that, you know, maybe what she said was not interesting enough or inflammatory enough. She did seem to be a bit sensitive to the criticism, but she said again that it's a very complex problem and a multifaceted problem, and she actually thanked Secretary Tillerson for being open-minded, saying open-mindedness is hard to come by these days.
Tillerson also met with some of the military leadership, correct?
Yes, that's right. He met with the Army chief, and you know, we didn't get an exact readout of what happened there, but he certainly conveyed to them U.S. concerns.
VOA State Department correspondent Cindy Sain joining us from the State Department. Cindy, as always, thanks so much.
Thank you, Ira.
China dispatched senior diplomat Song Tao to North Korea Friday to exchange views on matters between the two governments and parties. The Xinhua news agency did not indicate whether Pyongyang's nuclear and missile programs would come up in the talks. On Tuesday, the UN General Assembly's Human Rights Committee approved a resolution condemning the North for rights violations by neglecting the severe hunger facing its people while pursuing nuclear weapons. Kuro Besho is Japan's permanent representative.
Despite the people's need and successive Security Council resolutions, the DPRK authorities continue to divert their resources into pursuing nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles over the welfare of its people. Such a decision itself constitutes a serious human rights violation.
The resolution has 60 co-sponsors and moves on to the full 193-member General Assembly. North Korean diplomat Ja Song-nam denounced the resolution, accusing the United States and its allies of threats, blackmail, sanctions, and pressure that have cut the delivery of medical equipment and medicine and created obstacles in food production. Troy Stangarone of the Washington-based Korea Economic Institute tells VOA's Victor Beatty the resolution follows the Human Rights Council's Commission on Inquiry on North Korea, which in 2014 determined that the government was engaged in systematic, widespread, and gross rights violations.
What I think is significant is that each year there seems to be a few more countries that sponsor. I think there's growing awareness around the world that this is a regime that whatever one thinks of it, is taking and abusing its population. We have documentation of forced work. We have documentation of, you know, rape. We have documentation of political prisoners. You know, this is a regime that takes and abuses its people, and it does so for the benefit of the elite, and it's something that I think the world is finally catching up to.
Troy, from your perspective, did President Donald Trump's recent trip to Asia, including a stop in South Korea, make any difference?
I think the trip to South Korea was important. There has been some concern in South Korea that the United States might engage in a military operation without consulting South Korea. One of the things the president made clear when he was there is that he would not, as he said, bypass South Korea. I think it's important to remind everyone that we do need to be on the same page. I think it was good that the president publicly acknowledged that to South Korea, that this is something that directly impacts them and that we both need to be taking each other's concerns into consideration.
Mr. Trump said the North's nuclear and missile programs threaten the world and promised a major statement. In Washington, meanwhile, members of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee considered the president's authority to launch a nuclear strike, given tensions with Pyongyang. Senator Chris Murphy is a Democrat from Connecticut.
We are concerned that the president of the United States is so unstable, is so volatile, has a decision-making process that is so quixotic, that he might order a nuclear weapons strike that is wildly out of step with U.S. national security interests.
Retired Air Force General Robert Keller, former commander of U.S. Strategic Command, said the military does not blindly follow orders, that a presidential order must be legal. Retired Air Force Colonel Cedric Layton, who now operates his own consultancy, was asked what is considered an illegal order.
An order that would be immoral, that would violate the rules of war, that would be, for example, an order that would violate the rules of proportionality. For example, if there were an attack on United States forces using small arms fire and the response was a nuclear attack against that, that would violate the laws of proportionality. So if something like that were to happen, then the members of the military that are on the receiving end of those orders would have every right to refuse to execute that order.
From your vantage point and your military service, would you say that nuclear weapons would be part of a U.S. response to an imminent North Korean threat?
The use of nuclear weapons could potentially be a response to an imminent North Korean threat or a threat from any other country, but it is something that has only been theorized. It has never been put into practice, and war plans that are used to cover the North Korean scenarios that we've become familiar with in the military do not contemplate going after the North Koreans with a full-blown nuclear response.
Florida Republican Senator Marco Rubio warned his colleagues to tread lightly, saying America's allies and adversaries are watching closely. You're listening to VOA Asia Weekend. Australians have voted decisively in favor of legalizing same-sex marriage in a landmark postal survey. Almost 62% of those who took part in the non-binding poll favor allowing same-sex couples to wed, according to the Australian Bureau of Statistics, which carried out the 8-week ballot. Turnout was about 80%. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
61.6%.
This is a historic day for Australia. The emphatic result was greeted with jubilation around the country. Nearly 8 million people, about 62% of those who voted in the postal survey, are demanding that same-sex couples be allowed to marry. The result isn't legally binding, but Australia's centre-right Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull is promising a new same-sex marriage bill within weeks.
They voted overwhelmingly for fairness, for commitment, for love. And now it's our job as the Australian Parliament, all of us here, to get on with it and get this done before Christmas.
The No campaign said gay marriage would threaten religious freedoms and expose children to radical views on homosexuality in the classroom. Opponents of gay marriage say they'll respect the result of the postal survey. Lyle Sheldon from the Anti-Reform Coalition for Marriage has congratulated his rivals for their decisive victory.
This is a democracy and they have been relentless in this and they have seen the fruit of their relentlessness and their involvement in the political process. That's been rewarded today by this result.
The 8-week postal survey has at times been divisive and toxic, with accusations of bigotry and bullying on both sides of the argument. But for many Yes campaigners, the celebrations are continuing. At an event in Sydney, Robbie, an activist, said it had been an emotional day.
Thank you so much to the people of Australia. One little step of progress. I am so grateful. I am so happy.
The landmark vote comes 20 years after Tasmania became the last remaining Australian state to decriminalise male homosexuality. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Three UCLA basketball players accused of shoplifting in China admitted to the crime and apologized before coach Steve Alford announced they were being suspended indefinitely. LiAngelo Ball, Jalen Hill, and Cody Riley were described as, quote, good young men by Alford at a campus news conference Wednesday.
These young men are going to have to prove their words and actions that this isn't who they are and that they will not let their identity be defined by this incident. I know Jello, Cody, and Jalen well, and I'm confident that they have already begun to use this experience as a life lesson. They're going to have to regain the trust of this athletic department, of this university, and because this was such a high-profile international matter, the trust of the general public. Trust is earned. It isn't just given. These three young men will remain suspended indefinitely from our program as we work through the review process with the university's Office of Student Conduct.
The coach said the trio would not be allowed to suit up, practice, or travel with the team while the university continues to sort out the circumstances of last week's incident in Hangzhou, China. Ball, Hill, and Riley took turns admitting to their actions and apologizing, while also thanking President Donald Trump for intervening on their behalf with his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping. This is Jalen Hill.
I hope that this mistake will not define me as a person, but it shows I have messed up and can learn from it. I don't want to be known for this dumb mistake. I want to be known for my respectfulness and my love and passion for the game of basketball. This event has taught me a lot, and it has changed me in a way that I can't explain.
No questions were taken from a horde of media present. The players' and coaches' statements were made after President Trump asked Wednesday whether they would thank him for helping him secure their release from custody in China after being accused of shoplifting. In a tweet Wednesday, Trump said the players were headed for 10 years in jail. Flying drones are nothing new in the skies, but online retailers have been investing in them as a way to deliver goods faster and to those in hard-to-reach rural areas. But the automation doesn't stop there, as Arash Arabasadi tells us.
What once was science fiction is now a part of modern life. Flying drones are common these days, but they're increasingly proving their worth to online retailers and customers living in hard-to-reach areas.
My experience as a user has been very good. Because we live in the countryside, using a drone is very convenient and quick. It's very high-tech.
High-tech goes hand-in-hand with today's digital marketplace.
Technological and scientific progress will always lead to changes in the society, and the drone technology is only part of it. Our company wants to make contributions to the society, so we hope to cause less harm in the course of technological progress.
Automation at this workshop in Shanghai makes rapid growth possible for online retailer Best Inc.
Nowadays, it's hard to recruit a large number of people to do intensive manual work. If our business is to grow 50 to 60% a year, it's impossible to also increase manpower by the same percentage. Therefore, under these circumstances, I think technologies can improve efficiency in the long term.
So automation helps a retailer's output, but it's not without a human cost.
In the past, many positions were dependent on manpower. Now, because of modernization, after we implement automation, many positions have been replaced by machines. So in the future, it may become a problem for employment.
The future will likely mean fewer workers and more robots automating their jobs. But for now, at least, man and machine still need to work together as a team. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
This has been VOA Asia Weekend, a weekly wrap-up of stories that you can hear throughout the week on VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson. Join us again next week for VOA Asia Weekend.